Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
At some point during his time in a maximum security prison, according to the appeal, Richard Allen told his psychiatrist that he had shot the victims, the girls. Libby German and Abby Williams were not shot. They were killed with a blade. Any person who had actually committed these murders would know that. According to the defense's brief, Richard Allen did not. That detail sits at the center of everything you are about to hear. Yes, it's time to do another deep dive into Delphi, shall we? Join me and press subscribe wherever you're listening. And give us your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we go into one of the largest miscarriage of justice stories that we've ever covered. Because the Indiana Attorney General just filed the state's formal response to the appeal, and they describe the evidence in the case as, and I'm quoting directly from that document, conclusive and irrefutable. They want the Indiana Court of Appeals to leave Richard Allen's conviction exactly where it is, untouched for 130 years. And I tell you what, with a little bit of help from you, we're not going to let them do that. We're going to go through what they actually argue, and we're going to show you where it falls apart. Before we get into it, here's the frame. The state's response brief is the prosecution's formal rebuttal to every argument Allen's defense raised on appeal. Three major challenges are on the table. The search warrant that led to the gun and the bullet evidence was built on false or misleading statements. The confessions Allen made during 13 months of restrictive housing, that's a way to put it. He was in solitary confinement in a small box, not convicted of a crime. Is this supposed to be somebody supposed to be in county jail? He's in the darkest, most difficult, scary place for a human being to live. It's been legislated against. Even in Indiana, it's been legislated against leaving someone in there for more than 30 days, 60 days. It's a small window. They did 13 because why not? Because it's a suggestion over here. It's not technically a law. Oh, it is a law. Oh, we don't care. There's no accountability. We can do whatever the fuck we want. At least that's how it seems to be in Indiana. Can't solve a case? Now let's blame it on this guy and then railroad him and hope nobody pays attention. Our local media is shit. Oh, wait, what the hell's this? There's all these podcasters, all these independent journalists that are doing an actual job. The confessions Allen made during 13 months of being in the hole were the product of a broken mind, not a reliable memory. And the jury was systematically blocked from hearing evidence that could have changed the outcome. The state's answer to all three of those follows the same playbook. Either the issue was waived at trial, or it doesn't matter because the evidence of guilt was so overwhelming that nothing would have changed the verdict anyway, except there's no overwhelming evidence of guilt. There's a legal term for that second argument, harmless error. The state uses it like wallpaper throughout their response to the document that we're going to be going through here, and it will become important. One more thing before we go in. Allen's defense now has roughly 2 weeks to respond to the state's brief, and of course we'll bring that to you. The appeal is still moving, and the man at the center of it is serving his sentence in a prison in Oklahoma, transferred there from Indiana for his own safety, quote unquote. That's where things stand, and there's 1,000 issues with that as well. As we go through this, your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Let's talk about the warrant. The state's opening move on the search of Allen's home is procedural. Allen's lawyer said no objection at the trial when the gun and bullet evidence came in. So the state says, waived, can't raise it now. Set that aside. The underlying facts, don't move with it. Betsy Blair was on the Monon High Bridge Trail the afternoon Abby and Libby were killed. She saw the man known as Bridge Guy from roughly 50 feet away. She went to a sketch artist 3 days after the murders and described him, a young male in his 20s, curly, poofy brown hair, boyish face. She rated the composite sketch a 10 out of 10 for accuracy. Richard Allen was 44 years old. With closely cropped hair, the jury never saw the sketch. They never got to hold it up next to the man sitting at the defense table and decide what they thought. The state's response is that since Blair never made a formal identification of Allen, the sketch was irrelevant and potentially misleading to the jury. But that's exactly backwards. A witness who was on the bridge produced a sketch she called perfect, and it doesn't look like the defendant. The state didn't explain the discrepancy. Their answer was to make sure the jury never had to confront it. Now the confessions. And here's where the state's brief becomes genuinely difficult to read. The defense argues that 13 months in restrictive housing at maximum security prison or at a maximum security prison as a man who had not yet been convicted of anything systematically destroyed Richard Allen's mental health, and that the confessions that followed were the product of a psychotic episode, not memory. The state's rebuttal is to itemize his cell amenities. He had a mattress and a bed frame, a tablet, showered 3 times a week, a window. He was offered a television and declined. What the state's brief does not linger on is what the defense's documented record actually shows. According to the appellant's brief, Allen was found gravely disabled. He was involuntarily injected with antipsychotic medication because his deterioration had become so severe the prison couldn't wait for consent. He lost more than 40 pounds. He was drinking toilet water. Guards documented behavior so severe and so disturbing that the prison's own records read like something from a different century. He asked his psychiatrist if he was dead. On one phone call with his family, he told him, or told them, he believed the prison was poisoning him and compared his situation to Guantanamo Bay. He confessed to crimes against his own family members. Confessions those family members went into court and denied ever happened because they didn't. He was delusionally confessing to crimes that didn't exist. 2 days after confessing to Dr. Walla, he asked her whether he had said anything because he didn't remember. And at multiple points during those confessions, according to the defense's brief, he told people that he had taken a gun, a weapon like that, and took the girls out with that. However, that's not how they died. He did not shoot the girls. The state's 94-page response does not address that specific detail, not once. What they argue instead is that Allen began confessing before his psychosis formally peaked in early April and kept confessing after it and cleared in May, and therefore the confessions aren't tied to the breakdown. They offer 2 alternative explanations for why he started talking. He received his legal discovery at the end of March and had to face the evidence for the first time, and he had found religion in late March. But a new convert's desire to confess his sins may have driven what followed, except none of that is true. Both of those explanations are plausible on their surface, but neither one accounts for a man confessing to a crime and getting the manner of death wrong. That's not a man confessing from memory, that's something else entirely, and the state never explains what. And there's evidence the jury never got to hear. And this is where I want you to hold one question in your head the whole time, not whether any individual ruling was defensible, but what it means that they all went in the same direction. The jury didn't hear from Betsy Blair about the composite sketch. We talked about that. They also didn't hear from William Tobin, an expert who would have challenged the scientific validity of the methodology used to link the bullet to Allen's gun. Excluded because the court ruled he wasn't qualified in that specific sub-discipline, even as the defense's own firearms experts testified that the methodology was completely contested. They saw 15 videos of Allen's movement through the prison during the months he was confessing, and they watched those videos muted. The audio was excluded as hearsay. So they could see a man in obvious deterioration without ever hearing what he was saying. Two of three phone calls Allen made in April 3rd, calls where he told people he was losing his mind, that he was confused, that he questioned the reality of his own statements. Those were blocked because the court ruled the one call the state already admitted was complete enough on its own. Really, it means it contradicts their theory because it's complete enough on its own, right? Don't hear that. Shut your ears. Don't listen to real evidence. Let's just not give it to him, Judge. Okay. The jury heard the confession call. They didn't hear the calls around it that showed the state of the mind making it, and they just pretend there was nothing there. They heard nothing, not a word. About a year-long investigation into whether those murders were part of a ritual killing, an investigation law enforcement ran themselves. Within a week of those girls being found, the Carroll County Sheriff had already asked the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit to look at the sticks placed on their bodies and evaluate whether they were connected to pagan rituals. All of that existed. Investigators pursued it for years. The jury was told none of it. Sounds like a fair trial, doesn't it? Every one of those rulings may be legally defensible, standing alone, but every single one of them cut in the same direction. Every one of them took something away from the defense and gave nothing back. The jury got one picture of what happened in those woods, and they were told that picture was complete. The question the Court of Appeals now has to answer is whether that was fair, as a fair trial, or a managed one. Let's talk about the van. This is the state's most important argument, so I want to be precise. In his May 3rd confession to Dr. Walla, the one the state emphasized came after Allen's period of psychosis and formally cleared, even though he wasn't, Allen described seeing a van drive past while he had the girls. Seeing that van, he said, scared him and changed his plans. Investigators traced that detail to Brad Weber, a man who drove his white cargo van home from the Subaru plant in Lafayette that afternoon. The prosecution told the jury that was the detail only the killer would know. It became a centerpiece of closing arguments. Here's what the state's brief says about the defendant's challenge to Weber's timeline that Allen's attorneys failed to provide proper verification of the surveillance video timestamp, and that timestamps on security cameras are often inaccurate. The Hoosier Harvestone camera, they note, was running 54 minutes fast. It's a fair point. Timestamps can fail. But the defense wasn't relying solely on one neighbor's camera. They also cited FBI cell phone analysis placing Weber's phone arriving home significantly later than Weber's own testimony suggested. The state's answer to that, Allen offered no proper evidentiary foundation for the FBI data at trial. That may be procedurally accurate, but here's what it actually means in plain language. The state is not saying the FBI analysis is wrong. They're saying it wasn't introduced with the correct paperwork. The underlying timeline problem still exists outside the courtroom. Libby's phone showed movement stopping at 2:32 in the afternoon. The surveillance footage the defense obtained showed the van pulling towards that delivery or that driveway around 2:44. The FBI phone data pointed even later. If the van arrived after the phone had already stopped moving, after everything was already done, then Allen's description of seeing a van and being scared isn't the detail only the killer would know. It's the detail that doesn't match the timeline, and it doesn't match in the state's central argument for why we should trust the confession that it's resting on testimony that their own suppressed evidence calls into question. Which brings us all the way back to harmless error. That phrase does an enormous amount of lifting in this document. Every ruling that heard Allen's defense gets the same conclusion attached to it. Doesn't matter. Jury would have convicted him anyway. The evidence is overwhelming. That argument only holds if every pillar of the case is solid. A bullet comparison that, according to trial testimony, documented in the appeal, initially came back without a match before a different methodology was applied, and they called it the original methodology. That's very much in question of being legitimate in any way, shape, or form. Confessions from a man who was found gravely disabled, who got the cause of death wrong, who confessed to things his own family members have said never happened. A corroborating detail, the van tied to the timeline that the state's own evidence appears to undermine. A sketch rated perfect by the woman who made it, that the jury never got to see, that looks nothing like Richard Allen. If any one of those things was a crack in it, harmless error isn't a legal doctrine. It's the thing you say when you don't want to answer the question. Allen's defense will file a reply brief. Three appellate judges will eventually decide whether this trial met the constitutional standard, not whether Allen is guilty, but whether the process that convicted him was sound. That's the question on the table right now. The state says it was. They say everything was done right. They say a man exercised his free will and told the truth. But somewhere in the record of this case, there's a man asking his doctor if he's dead, saying he shot two people who were actually killed with a blade, and is being called a voluntary confession as being a credible witness to his own crime. Even though that timeline and his story make no sense, because he was in an active state of psychosis when he gave it. The state spent 94 pages explaining why that's acceptable. They never explain why he got it wrong. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. If you're just diving into this, there are so many details that it'd be impossible to cover here in this one piece. That's why we've already done hundreds of them. So if you look back in our archive here on the Hidden Killers podcast or on our YouTube channel, just type in Delphi on our channel. You'll be pleasantly surprised that there are literally hundreds of videos to help inform you and educate you on the topics. If you want to dive into this, it's there. Oh, my friends, it is there. We'll be diving deeper into this week with Bob Mata, defense attorney, and discussing what the next steps are, what all this means in greater detail from a defense attorney standpoint. So be sure to join us for that. Press subscribe so you don't miss it. We'll continue the conversation in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Delphi, we are going to dive deep into it today. A lot of people already in the chat waiting. Welcome, everyone. Be sure to drop your comments in as we go through this. There's a lot to get through in this case. The latest, the Indiana Attorney General just told the appeals court that Richard Allen's conviction is solid. It was a fair trial. 130 years is exactly what he deserves. 94 pages saying everything was done right. But here's the thing about those 94 pages. They never once explain why the man who confessed to killing Abby Williams and Libby German said he shot them. They weren't shot. The silence is the starting point. for this conversation. And we're going to break it down, going to break down the state's response, going to break down what the defense has been arguing and what happens next in this whole case. Joining us to do so, as always, my co-host, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, and our good friend, Bob Mata, defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries. Welcome, gentlemen. Bob, let's start with you. You messaged me the other day right when this dropped. This is the state's response to the submission by the defense of Richard Allen. Explain to all of us non-attorneys out there what this means and what your reaction is as we're going to kind of go through some of their responses to the points that the defense for Richard Allen has made.
Well, hello, boys. It's good to see you guys.
Bob.
Love it, man. I've decided we should call this segment DMB, not Dave Matthews Band, but Tariq Mata and Brewski. So, you know, it's got a nice ring to it. So, yeah, I mean, first and foremost, just so people understand, so Allen's team filed their brief, and then you get the appellee's brief. And there's one more bite at the apple for the defense, so a reply will be forthcoming. It'll probably take another 60 to 90 days to get that. Mm-hmm. And then once that hits, it'll all go up to the judges, and the panel will start reading through it, start going through the record, and then they'll start crafting their opinion. I just hope that they're not going to use AI to do it. it's a thing. I've been hearing.
I saw a headline on that today. Like some ridiculous amount of like circuit judges are relying on AI for a lot of their decisions.
Yeah. It's a thing, man. It's a thing, and it does concern me. But to your question, which is really, you know, why didn't the AG's team kind of deal with this inconsistency of, you know, his confessions, wherein he's clearly saying things that obviously didn't happen. And, mm-hmm. and the reason they do that, because there's really no good answer. You know, I mean, a competent appellate team, when they're engaging with a fact that really does more damage by engaging in it than just ignoring it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's your kind of simple answer. I mean, if you address the wrong cause of death in the confessions, then you basically have two options, which are both awful. You know, one, you can argue the man can confess to a murder and get the manner of death completely wrong, right? And the confession is still reliable. And that's a losing argument on its face, really, because it undermines the very premise of the confession evidence itself.
Yeah.
And that it demonstrates insider knowledge. Or the second option is you try to minimize it and maybe argue it was a slip of the tongue or confusion. But then the problem with that is that you conceded that the confessor was confused. And now you're one step away from the defense's argument being a winning argument, which is that these confessions were just the product of a deteriorating mind, you know?
100% they were. So, Bob, the thing that I just don't understand, because it just doesn't make any sense, and I know you probably can't make sense of it either, because this judge, this whole thing has just been so crazy stupid. So, and I'm probably got this wrong. You are so much closer and are so much closer to this case than me. But so a large part of this case was the round they said they found there that they said was Richard Allen's round. And they said it was from his gun, even though it wasn't fired. It was just an unspent round. And they said it matched his weapon. How's that even matter if they weren't killed by a firearm?
Yeah, I mean, their theory on the case has always been, which there's problems with this as well, but that bridge guy had a gun, pulled it on the girls up on the bridge, racked the gun, and that was his show of force in order to gain control over two athletic, you know, young teenage girls. And that, you know, as a former Fed, you're obviously familiar with weapons, and you know that the problem with that theory is that
yes,
cartridge would have popped out right there when he racked, you know, the round mm-hmm. was shot out. And, you know, where we're talking about this round being found is across a creek, you know, down a hill, across a creek and up into Ron Logan's property, you know, and it's found in between the girls. So, I mean, that's a problem for them. So, but that's how they introduce the round as being relevant in this case, because they're saying that a handgun was used in order to control the girls to get them to their final resting place.
And how did they come up with that?
They say that in the audio, and they testified to this at court during the trial, that you can hear him rack the gun.
And there's no video of him racking the gun.
There's no witnesses.
They say they can hear it. They say they can hear it.
You can't hear really, exactly. So you can barely hear. There's a noise, which could have been really anything. That's racking a gun. Where's the gun? There's no gun in this. What are you talking about? Nobody's seen a gun. Oh, where's a gun? This reminds me. I mean, it reminds me of when I was a kid. I remember going and playing in the creek, and we would one day we found a carpet rolled up underneath the bridge that was near my parents' house. And we're, 10, 12, and so our minds are going nuts. We think, oh, there's a body rolled up in this carpet. So we wander the creek, and we find all this other random crap that people have thrown in. There's, like, old, rusty telephones. There's all sorts of random shit in this creek in Wisconsin. And we, as children, put this all together in my treehouse, and we were solving the crime. Who killed the person that's rolled up in the carpet underneath the bridge? And the reasoning that we put the story together. Well, they use the telephone for this. They use this rope for that. Whole story. And it's all just, figments of our imagination, but we're applying all these random things to this thing that doesn't even really exist. This is about as good as that.
Yeah.
Massive confirmation bias, man.
Yes. It reminds me of just absurdity, but being taken with such a level of seriousness that only those who are coming up with it could possibly believe, but obviously enough have side,
which just we've all been through it. I mean, with this case, this is the most least likely individual on the face of the planet before you even get to the lack of stupid evidence.
My favorite thing about that story is we get a peek behind the curtain into how the Tony Bruschi that we all know and love now was born.
Oh, there's stories.
The Artie boys back there. I love
it. Exactly. Yeah. I ended up putting all those things in my treehouse and called it the Underwater Museum. Until eventually I grew up and then they took it down and they're like, all this like artifacts from the creek are in there. Who knows? We might have actually had some evidence in there from real crimes. Awesome. The state in their response describes Allen's solitary confinement conditions. And we've obviously been in an uproar about this for years now of where he's been. And they're really trying to they're trying to play it up like he's at the Ritz. He's got a mattress. He's been offered a tablet. He showers 3 times a week. Apparently there's a window at some point in here. They spent a lot of time talking about the creature comforts in here. What is spending that much time on ink, on the cell amenities, which there really aren't many? You wouldn't expect any either in the hole. But what does it tell you about where Indiana thinks it's most exposed that they're like, well, we offered him a tablet. We did this and he did that. And well, what's your reaction to their, I guess, their framing of it in their response?
Yeah. If I'm the appellate lawyers for Allen, my mindset is that when you spend that much ink on a particular issue, that in their mind, talking about the state, that it's their biggest vulnerability. They're really trying to reframe the narrative before the court gets to the constitutional question, so they're listing the amenities is a classic prosecution move. I mean, Tony at trial, they took great exception to the fact that he was in solitary. They just called it a single person cell. that's the epitome of what we're talking about
here. Yeah.
Like the defense would say he's in solitary and the state would say he wasn't in solitary. He was in a single person cell. That's all. So, look, if you're being intellectually honest about this, you can't argue that 13 months of solitary confinement for a pretrial detainee wasn't harsh, right? I mean, them arguing that fact discredits them because any normal human being is going to be saying this guy was innocent at this point in time. He was innocent until proven guilty, and you've got him being trained like he's a war criminal. And it's unbelievable to me.
Bob, how come no psych is out here screaming about the effects of solitary or single room confinement on an individual and what it does to them mentally. I mean, it's not just the research, but practical applications of this. When this case first broke, and Tony and I were covering it, and you were, you know, on the show too.
Yeah.
You know, I just got done reading all these expeditions to Antarctica and in the effects, even when you are with a small group of people, but in isolation, even with all the resource you have, your brain goes nuts. There's zero rational thought left, because the way our brains work, we need social interaction in order to keep our cognitive functions. Otherwise, we start losing it.
Yeah.
And this is so clearly what was going on here, especially when the confession doesn't include in the first round any details that were actually accurate.
You know what? I mean, it's a great question. I mean, the defense called a couple of witnesses, Grassian, but he was really called not to get into the specifics of Richard Allen and his confessions, but kind of like broad generalizations of how false confessions are formed in our mind and how it kind of operates. And it's that concept which I found fascinating, because I you know, when I was sitting in court watching the trial, because I had never really thought about this, but like when you are recalling a memory, you know, the first time that you do it, that becomes the next thing that you remember. So when you know, if you've told a story 20 times and you're going back on the 21st time, what you're recalling is the 20th time that you've remembered that particular memory. So you're not going back to the actual memory of it. So all the bastardization that will take place, because our minds work in mysterious ways, is what you're remembering on that 20th memory. So any kind of facts that you may, you know, and we have a tendency as human beings to do that. We want to fill in gaps, right? You know, I mean, if our initial memory of the thing was, you know, there were a couple of holes in what we remember, over time, psychologically, we start wanting to fill those holes in, and we do oftentimes. So I just found that was really fascinating, but that didn't really go to the issue of what you're talking about, which I have to say I was left wanting walking onto that trial in terms of exactly what you're talking about. Why wasn't there somebody on the stand just pounding the jury over the head with the concept that, look, we know from the doctors in the prison that he was psychotic. I mean, we had him involuntarily administering Haldol. That's the level of his psychosis at this point. So why wasn't there that witness there saying, okay, now that we know that that was a fact, how do we address what was happening and what he was saying? How does that impact it? Because I think that the question that was never really answered, which I think is still hanging out there, well, okay, he's psychotic, but why does that automatically mean that he's not telling the truth? Which really goes back to Tony's first question. So, and that's where your answer lies, because you've got a guy that's saying both, he's talking out of both sides of his mouth. One, he's giving general, which Robin, I think you would attest to, saying I did it is not a real confession. You know, you need facts. You need something to support the fact that you're saying something more than I did it, which is essentially what they had him saying. But then you've got those counter statements wherein he's giving absolutely incorrect facts, you know, like in terms of how the girls died, or that they were sexually molested, or that, you know, he had abused his own child, or that, you know, he had started World War III. He's clearly saying these things that aren't logical, that are clearly not true, you know. And as far as addressing, you know, the abuse of his daughter, you know, his daughter got on the stand and testified that's absolutely not true. Right. You know, so, but in terms of your question, I wish I had a better answer. I don't know. I think it was a missed opportunity by the defense in that. And I think it is something that had to be addressed.
And I got one follow up to that too, Bob. And that is, as I don't know how do you admit this, or if you can put it in there as evidence, because it's so subjective, it's behavior based. I know where that goes a lot of times in court, but if you actually, I did an analysis, and if you look at the overhears and the recordings between him and his wife, because I know you've seen them interact, you've been there when they're interacting, the amount of focus he has had on her and his family in every statement that he's made, comparatively to everyone else they've accused of similar crimes and actually have been convicted and actually did do the crime, it's night and day.
Yeah.
He is such a far outlier. Every single thing he says and does is about the impact of what he's being accused of, the impact on the family, the impact on the wife. Everyone else, that all self-centered narcissist that just wants to abuse others, kill others, or whatever it is, it's all about the impact on me, all about me, 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 me.
Yeah.
He is completely flipped. That's why just behaviorally, the isolation or the one room luxury hotel, whatever it is such a deviation from what people do.
Yeah.
And is that admittable? Can it be brought up, or is it just too subjective?
No, I mean, I think you could have called an expert. Whether or not Gull would have let that expert in is a different story. You know, I mean, that's the reality of the situation. I mean, the defense was really barred from putting in a lot of things that they felt were relevant and would be helpful. Because, like, the cue for the judges, is it helpful for the jury in terms of expert opinion? And I certainly think that would be. You know, but like she was of the mindset, I'm not going to let the defense put anything on that may shade away from the fact that I believe that he's guilty.
Yes.
So,
yeah. You know, it sounds exactly like her.
Yeah. I mean, thank God she's gone.
Whatever. Oh, man.
What struck me before we kind of move more into the defense of things, what struck me about this response from the state was the fact that they really are speaking out of their mouth from two different sides. Where in one, you know, one part they're talking about the gun and the confession of Richard Allen, where he says he shot them. And well, see, he admits to it, but they weren't shot. Yeah. But that other part, that's reliable. That's good. But that other part, it's okay. He was kind of nuts, so that we don't need to worry about that. But over here, this is okay. And then we go over to the van. And it's like, see, he had knowledge of the van, even though their timeline is all messed up, which that's a whole other part of the conversation of timestamps being wrong. And there's other videos for that if you want to take a deep dive into that, anybody, to explain all of it. But then they go to the van. See, he's reliable here because he claims he saw the van at X time. So this party's reliable. This party's not. That party kind of, it's like, either he is or he isn't. Like, you can't just like pick the parts that are the best and then everything else that doesn't quite go with your narrative. Well, we're just going to omit those intellectually and by law and just kind of, you know, it's okay. We're right over here. That's the part that's insane to me, but this is how people work. I mean, they like to grab onto the things that confirm their own bias. Confirmation bias is what we have going on here, it seems, but it's to such an extreme where no matter what evidence is directly in front of them, it's really just stunning how they pretend it doesn't exist or that it doesn't have any sort of meaning.
Yeah, no, I mean, they want their cake and they want to eat their cake and have it too, or whatever the hell.
They want the whole aisle of cake, cake boxes. Yeah,
it goes to what Robin said like earlier, man. It's confirmation bias, and if it doesn't fit their narrative, they're simply going to try to you know talk it away. You know, and the reality is, that's not how the system's supposed to work. You know, you're not supposed to be trying to pound these square pegs into round holes or round pegs into square holes. But, you know, you see the state do it all the time, you know, and that's really when I talk to people about this case, you know, and I'm going to say this for all three of us. All three of us absolutely want justice for Abby and Libby. You know, the three of us are not sitting here rooting for a killer. The fact of the matter is that none of the three of us trust this conviction. And it's exactly for the reasons that you just pointed out, Tony. You know, if you have an intellectually honest case and you've got the evidence, well, go in there and prove it. You know, don't talk out of both sides of your mouth. Don't ignore facts that exist as if they don't, you know, because when you do that kind of stuff, that leaves me to one conclusion, and that's that this is a crap case and it should never have been brought. And then, you know, when you compound it with the fact that you have a judge that did everything in her power to disallow Richard Allen to have a fair trial, I have a problem with it, you know? And I feel
the other confessions that came in, you know, that were, I think, a hell of a lot more credible because the life arc of those individuals actually did things like this, you know, right. And so why not even consider that? Because reasonable doubt, oh shit, this thing is full of nothing but reasonable doubt.
When you're dealing with a bunch of people who are not reasonable in any way, shape, or form, that's really where a lot of this seemed to have been. Your thoughts in the comment section on this part on Substack and YouTube. Be sure to jump in. Give us your thoughts. Give us your opinions. We read them. We'd love to see them. The prosecution built its entire closing argument around a very specific detail, the detail only the killer would know. Richard Allen confessed to seeing a van drive past during the attack on Abby and Libby, according to the prosecution, and then, you know, said he killed him with a gun. That van that the state told the jury belonged to a real neighbor who really did drive that road that afternoon. Case closed, according to them. Except the defense obtained surveillance footage showing that the van arrived significantly later than the state's witness testified, and FBI cell phone data pointing later still. The state's answer is that the paperwork wasn't filed correctly. Not that the content was wrong. It's just you didn't quite, meet the bar. You didn't cross the T dot the I on the minutia of it. Now that the data is wrong, and separately documented in the defense's own brief, Allen also told his psychiatrist that he had shot the girls. They were killed with a blade. The state's 94-page response never touches that detail. In this segment, we're going to be talking about what happens when the centerpiece of a prosecution may not hold, and the confession meant to prove it got the most basic fact of the crimes wrong. Let's start there. The prosecution told the jury only the killer would know about the van. That was their proof. The confession was real. If the van didn't arrive when the state's witness said it did, if it arrived after Libby's phone had already stopped moving, what does that do to the entire foundation of that argument that it was built on, Bob?
It guts it. You know, the only the killer would know argument is one of the most powerful tools that a prosecutor has when they're trying to validate a confession, right? I mean, it tells the jury, this man knew something that wasn't public, something that only someone who was there could know, right? And that proves the confession is real. So when the prosecution pointed to Allen's mention of the van and tied it to a real neighbor who really did drive the road, that road in particular, it was catastrophic for the defense, and the detail was, really supposed to make everything more credible for the state. And I think in the eyes of the jury, it did. The problem for the state and for reality is that there existed this particular piece of evidence that didn't come in at trial, that came out during post-conviction when there was a document called a motion to correct errors that was filed. And in that motion to correct errors, they attached this video that showed that Weber, and that's who was driving the white van, he was getting off work from the Subaru plant, which is in West Lafayette, which is anywhere between 20 and 30 minutes. So you have the time of death, which the state is assigned as like around, I think 3:22. And then you've got Weber, them saying he's driving down that road. So that means, in the state's theory, that if you're to believe Richard Allen's confession with the details only the killer would know, that he sees the van, it spooks him, and that's when he decides he has to kill the girls. Okay, so that happens in and around 3:22 as a result of him seeing the van. Problem is, during the motion to correct errors, they find this piece of evidence that was turned over by the state. Okay, this wasn't something that the defense dug up. It came in the discovery, unfortunately, for whatever reason, but probably because it was a huge amount of discovery and tons and tons and tons of video, hundreds of hours, and they went to trial quickly because they felt that they were concerned that Allen wouldn't survive to get to trial, so they really pushed it, and they forced it to trial, in my opinion. I was really hoping that they were going to delay it because I knew that there was more stuff they had to get into. But that van shows Weber actually driving down that access road at 3:44 p.m. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that kind of absolutely obliterates the state's theory, doesn't it? But the state's concept was, okay, well, that, we see that van, but we can't trust that timestamp and you have no way to prove it. But my rebuttal to that would be that the FBI and their cell phone data showed that he connected to his Wi-Fi at 3:50.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that corroborates that pretty well in terms of when he drove down that access road. So, Man, I mean, it's another one of those things that, you know, I really hope the appellate court is going to dive into, because I have to say it. I mean, the elephant in the room with regard to the appeal itself is that it exposed a lot of deficiencies in terms of what happened at trial, in terms of the defense failing to preserve appellate issues by objecting at trial. Okay. So, I mean, that's a reality.
Yeah.
That's a reality. A lot of times the appellate courts are going to look at it and be like, all right, I see that the state has argued 94 pages of the merits. However, their initial argument is the correct one, which is that they waived it. It's not before us because the defense failed to failed to object at trial. Because you can have the situation where you have a pretrial hearing, right, on a motion, and you fight. And that is noting that there's an issue, and you mm-hmm. can file a motion to reconsider to the judge, and the appellate court can know that you have an issue with it. The problem is you have to restate that objection at trial. And it appears, and I haven't read every bit of the record, this is going to have to be addressed to some extent in the reply, where they're going to have to go through the record and see if they can kind of work through, like, okay, well, they did object to this, but like when the things like the gun came in and like things that they had objected to through the Franks memo, when they were asking for that, where they were attacking the search warrant, where they recovered these things mm-hmm. like the jacket and the gun. And so they're obviously saying, we got a problem with this. We think Liggett came in and lied in order to get that order, that search warrant. And at that point, when they introduce it into evidence, the defense had to object to it again. Mm-hmm. And the problem is in the record, this one, I know they said, we have no objection. So that's going to be the problem with this particular issue and this appellate brief, is that for those issues in particular, we're talking about like the first two things we've been talking about are, there's basically four issues in the appellate brief that Allen's lawyers filed. The first two of what we've been talking about. And I have to say, we had a pretty amazing panel last night, and I'm going to kind of promote me a little bit here.
Absolutely.
But, you know, I had Andrea Burkhardt and Allie, who are two of the most brilliant attorneys that I know, defending the appellants, which mm-hmm. is Richard Allen's brief. And then I had Michael Osbrook, who was an equally brilliant attorney who does habeas work, which is post-conviction work, and has an unbelievable win rate. The guy's brilliant. And I had him put on the white hat because he used to be a deputy attorney general back in mm-hmm. the old days. So he had been in that position. So I had him. And even though Michael is actually the one who wrote the motion to correct errors in the Delphi case, so he's well equipped. And I knew it was putting him in an awkward position to have to argue for the state on this. And, you know, and during that debate, and that's how I did it, I was the moderator. I had him on a clock. I had him on a time. It was really a fascinating exercise. But, I think everybody kind of came to that conclusion that those issues, and Michael said it definitively, that are going to be dead in the water. The appellate courts are not going to give some kind of leeway because they see that the importance of the merits. They're going to say, look, we're going to hang our hat on the easiest thing we can, and which is that you waived it and it's not before us. So, I mean, that's a reality that that everybody needs to know. Anybody mm-hmm. that follows the case, that I want people to understand that on those first two issues, I think they're dead in the water, even though I think the reality is that they're incredibly important issues. And I think that it's a real shame that they're not going to get addressed in terms of the merits of the issue.
Sure.
So,
well, and I want to get into some of that in our next segment about, you know, what's going to be coming up next here.
Yeah.
I want to hit on this, just kind of going back to, cause this is an element that always kind of gets me, where, okay, he saw the van. I mean, this is their argument that they're trying to make. He saw the van and that spooked him. And then that's why he killed the girls.
Yep.
Huh? I mean, like, you saw a van, then you decided must kill the girls? Like, okay, and number one, how the bodies were found. I mean, then did he give him a bath and then clean him up? And I mean, like, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make logical sense. It doesn't make physical sense for the way they were found. And for him to have
done all of this in this short period of time. I mean, it's just a very simple, saw the van, killed the girls. Let's say it out loud and keep repeating it and we'll all believe it. But if you actually just look at the, I mean, number one, the timing, that's a whole other part of it. But if just the, from a psychological standpoint, what?
Like, no, it's not the way it works.
It's like, why? Why would that be the lever that he pulls?
And that's not a panic escalation in those moments. No, anyway.
And he killed the girls. And again, that's why he killed the girls. That's where he shot the girls, according to him. And they were not shot. So that's why he killed the girls, even though the method of killing is, all of it doesn't make sense.
And it gets worse than that. Because then you introduce Sarah Carbaugh, who says that she sees Bridge Guy or a muddy and bloody man. It like after 4 o'clock, which means that Alan does this incredible thing because he sees a van. He feels like, oh God, I may have been spotted. I have to now kill the girls to like make things even worse for me. Other than the fact that somebody just saw me with two girls. Now I'm going to murder them both. And then I'm going to run around the woods like some kind of wood imp.
And I'm going to jump in with this panic escalation. Because the panic escalation here, as they're claiming it was, he saw the van, so he said, I got to kill the girls fast. Last thing you do is take out a knife. You got the gun in your hand, supposedly. You shoot them, then run.
Yeah.
I mean, because the first impulse when you panic is fight or flight. Run. If he thinks the girls witnessing him there is going to be an issue, you don't stab, declothe, clothe, drag. I mean, you just go. I mean,
in the middle of the day, by the way, on a nice hiking day where a lot of people are out, you're going to do all this and there's get no blood on you. And the girls are cleaned up magically. Their blood seems to be gone for the most part, too. And it's like this. None of it makes sense. It's like, OK, tell the story. And then you look at the evidence like, well, that doesn't add up. Like,
yeah, and Robin, let me ask you, as a former Fed, retired Fed, you see that guy's picture, you can see his hand, all right? So that's not a guy who is suited up to not leave DNA. If you've got a guy who Sarah Carbaugh claims is muddy and bloody, and that is, in fact, the same person who just killed the girls, if that guy has their DNA all over him, I guarantee that guy would have his DNA all over them.
Both. Oh, yeah.
And Alan's DNA isn't anywhere to be found anywhere in these two brutal murders.
Yeah.
Can you explain that to me as if I'm five so that I can understand how that could happen, Robin?
It can't. And well, and we have a comparison contrast right now. Just look at the Nancy Guthrie case. What did that guy get sued up in? You know, and this just goes to that arc of you don't go from I've never sexually abused or killed kids to all of a sudden I am. And, you know, from 0 to 100. But let's say for a chance that we just don't know about those other cases. Right. Then you have at least one or two reps. So you're not going to wear that outfit. You're going to look like the guy on Nancy Guthrie's front step is suited up. He's got gloves on, you know, leaves no DNA trace, or even a Koberger, you know, same thing. That's Koberger's first attempt at it. What's he dressed like? All you saw was the big bushy eyebrows. You know, so this is not what someone wears to do that. He is slumbering across a bridge, you know, out trying to get his thoughts together because he's going through a stressful time in life. You know, just
Here's another thought on it. Okay, I know it was several years after when they went into Rick's house and they took the jacket that they say is the jacket of Bridge Guy, which again, that's a whole other part. Like, why is Bridge Guy the murderer? Like, there's no real evidence to say that he is, other than that somebody thinks they heard a gun. It was a guy walking across a bridge. There's really nothing that connects the man to the death of these girls, other than a video where they're confused as to where they're going and goes down the hill. Suddenly, that means like I'm a mass murderer and I kill you and I'm wearing a Carhartt jacket. Woo! If he did this, and in this crime would have been very bloody for whoever did it. The girls were certainly cleaned up by the time where they were found. Yes, you could technically clean a jacket in the course of all those years. What did you have? I mean, I would guess there'd be some DNA residue somewhere within the fibers of that jacket that there ain't no amount of Tide with bleach that's going to completely get out, no matter how well you do it. And you're still hanging on to the jacket all those years later. The jacket that you killed those kids with, you just couldn't part with. You couldn't go buy another one for $79.99 down at the Atwoods. No, we're going to hold on to the murder jacket.
And
there's no evidence on it.
Now, so let's just, now we can go down down that road, you know, do a little thought experiment. Yeah. All right. So let's say he held on the jacket. So why do people hold on to things? Well, because they're trophies, so they can remember it, you know, because this is what serial killers do, but this isn't a serial killing, but this is what murderers do. They hold on to trophies if they're going to hold on to something, and then they covet it. They secrete it in a secret place, because we were talking about secret places yesterday, so that you could actually keep it private, keep it just for you, for your mental, you know, little gyrations you're having. He didn't do that. It's hanging in a closet.
Yeah. It's a normal jacket. He's wearing it.
The state's answer for that has been that they found the round in his keepsake box. That was – so theoretically, you'd have to take the logical leap that, number one, Alan knew that he – so this is where you have to go with this. So, again, for him to not have left DNA on the girls, that means, as Tony said, that he would have – you know, okay, let's pretend he did – he cleaned the girls. He went to the great lengths to clean the girls. However, he racked the gun again.
In the creek?
Down there. But Clee goes to the great lengths to clean the girls. But then after he racks the gun, he decides not to pick up his round. Okay? And he leaves that smoking gun piece of evidence in the state's world at the crime scene. And then that means in their world, he'd have to be aware of it in order for him to assign any kind of actual meaning to the round that they found in the memory box. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because yeah. if he drops the round, he's not aware of it. There's no significance to him keeping a round in his box to remember it, because the gun didn't really have anything to do with the crime. Right. So it has to be that thing where, okay, he racks his gun, the gun pops out, he goes and cleans the girls, or at least he cleans Abby, because
yeah,
you know, Libby was still very bloody.
Yeah.
You know, and then forgets about this round. You know what I mean? But you can't have it where he's aware that he ejected the round, decides not to pick it up after he cleans up the rest of the crime scene, and then goes home and he's like, oh, you know what? I'm going to keep a round from the same magazine, and I'm just going to keep it in this box so I can always have that memory. It's incongruous, man. It doesn't work. You can't, again, you can't have it both ways, because it's like if he unwittingly leaves the round at the scene after he's cleaned up everything else, that round in the box would have no significance because he's not aware that he left a round there. You know what I mean?
You know, I mean,
it's right. It wasn't the murder weapon.
I know. If he lent a shot off, you might want to keep the shell casing from it. But generally, those will have etchings if someone actually was intending to use it for, you know, because we've seen that in other cases. Just the whole thing is just lacking in what people do if they're going to do something horrendous like this. There's nothing that lines up.
There's just so much in this case where, okay, you're going to go down the road, the whoever it is that's, oh, I found this piece of paper, let's look at Rick Allen, and they do. Okay, go look at Rick Allen. There's nothing wrong with, you know, let's track down leads and see if there's anything there. And they get all this information. They know these things, and yet they just keep trying to hammer the damn peg into the hole, no matter how it doesn't fit. To a reasonable investigator, I think you go, yeah, I mean, I'm glad we looked down this road, but clearly this is not our guy. But
his first interview was so telling, too. His first interview he gave is when I said it ain't him, because he was so – because the first thing you're looking for is you're looking for transparency. You're looking for openness. You're looking for both verbally, non-verbally, cell phones. I mean, so if they wanted his cell phone, you know, and he had everything right on the table in front of him. I mean, there was, like, no issue of trying to – hide anything, being coy. There was no deviations, and it was a good first interview of him. And I'm like, there's nothing here. I have no idea why they doubled down on him after that.
Because in their mind, the round was the link.
You know what I mean? They couldn't be wrong after they made their
wrong. They were desperate to solve this case. It was 5 years cold. The round for them was the end all be all. It was the piece of evidence that they'd been searching for, and that there was no change in their mind. And you didn't see that with Mullins in the first interview, but you saw it with Holman in the second. Right? I look, here's what I want to do. I want to have you two guys over to my house. And I want to watch with Robin and Tony. I want to watch that second video because I want to hear Robin's thoughts on it and yours, T, in terms of, like, from a Fed's perspective, like when you're watching that interrogation video, because that's where he's really coming at him hard, because Mullins used the read technique, but in a much more, like, low key type of way. Whereas Holman full blown, just ram the Reed technique down his throat. And, you know, Allen still never cracks, you know, right. And it's that thing where he's saying, and it goes back to your earlier point in our last segment, which if you guys haven't watched, you should go back and watch. We were talking about how Allen has little regard for himself. Everything that matters to him most in his life is his wife and his family, you know, and you hear that in that second interview, you know, where the only thing that pisses him off is when they mess with his wife.
Yeah.
You know, that's when the only time he gets heated is when they're going at Kathy, because go ahead, Robin.
Yeah. And on that, so if you look at the history of people that do these things to girls, young girls, they don't have that kind of relationship with that kind of caring towards their wives or spouses or even significant others. It just is non-existent. Yeah. And so if we can go on the premise, because it's her optic as well as his optic, that this marriage and this relationship is everything to them, how do these actions he took benefit that relationship, or does it hinder it? And so even if it is some sort of sickness in him, there would have been leakage way before this then. It just doesn't happen. It just – I can't keep saying it enough. It just doesn't happen. It's not even outliers. There's no even outliers on this one.
No, there really isn't.
You know, there's so much value in that. You know, because you did the damn thing. You know, it's one thing for me as a defense attorney to be sitting here screaming and hollering. It's another thing for a guy who did the damn thing. And you know, I mean, you were out there. You're learned in the ways of how these guys operate in a way that it gives credence to what I think everybody that's on the side of, like, Allen's not the guy. You know, and it's validating for me to hear. Anytime that I have somebody that was in that business, namely the FBI, that is echoing what we've all been saying, you know. So I thank you for that, man. It really it makes me feel better about a lot of things. So,
well, thanks. And because all we do every day is we look for outliers of behaviors, we look for outliers of everything. And I'll tell you, when I even first saw this case at the very, very beginning that Tony and I started first covering it, was the outlier is Allen's relationship with his wife.
Yeah.
That's an outlier. I have not seen any behavior like that in interviews. And then when you cascade on all the other things, like the confession, the solitary, all these things, the round, everything kept emphasizing not the guy. And then when you just, again, everything comes down to me, you start with relationships. In my line of work, the first thing I asked was, is this guy liked or not liked? How the relationships, and this is always the first thing to do, is I got to look at the relationships in life, because that's going to give me a clue about how serious we need to look at this person versus this person, this person versus this person, because happy people don't do bad shit. Right. And good, healthy relationships typically don't either. Doesn't mean all bad relationships do, but that's where you're going to start focusing. And when you have the type of relationship that we saw on display multiple times, tears, genuine emotion between both parties, including daughter, it's just a complete.
And I'm here to tell you, Robin, like, so when I was covering that trial, we covered, you know, the whole thing from beginning to end, from arrest through trial. And, you know, I became close with the Allen family, you know, not just Kathy, but Rick's mother and Rick's stepfather, Ken, who had raised him, who he considers to be his father. And these are like salt of the earth, like just the most down to earth people that you'll ever know. And I'm not talking about just niceties, like, hi, how you doing? I'm talking about, like, we ate lunch every day together during the trial. I sat next to them during the trial. I really got to know these people fundamentally. And I asked, Kathy, a lot of hard questions, you know. And the one thing that absolutely shone through about that is that these are two people that were married for 35 years, and there wasn't one fiber of Kathy that believed that Rick not only didn't do this, but that was even capable of it, you know. And you are not pulling the wool over somebody's eyes that you've been with since you were in high school for 35 years. I'm sorry. It's just not going to happen. You know, you're going to see a crack in that facade. Like, if I'm asking Kathy questions, you know, was there anything ever kind of like off about some shit? Was there some shit? Because when you look at like Asa Huerman,
right? That's the exact one I was brought. There's no secret place. There's no secret room. There's no secret place.
He's not all Rex. No.
Right.
No. That's what that looks like.
Yes.
And that is not.
It's a perfect compare and contrast.
Yeah. I love one of the comments I saw on here. These cops aren't even good at being bad at what they do. I think it's what it's, I just lost it. But it's like, yeah, that's true. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube on this piece of our conversation. We'd love to hear your feedback. Three appellate judges are going to read both briefs. They're not going to decide whether Richard Allen is guilty. That's not their job. Their job is to decide whether the trial that convicted him was constitutionally sound, whether the process met the standard this country requires. That's a narrower question than guilt or innocence, but in some ways it's more uncomfortable because it forces the system to examine itself. A reply brief from Allen's defense is coming. Oral arguments are possible, and whatever these three judges decide will either close this chapter or blow it wide open. Bob Mata is with us to help break it down. Earlier in the conversation, if you go back to another segment, or if you're watching the long one, you've just heard it. Bob, you were saying that some of these points that have been made by the state are going to be dead in the water when it comes to the arguments back from the defense of Richard Allen. I want to talk more about that, and I want to talk more about, okay, they get another shot here at the apple. What are they going to be bringing to the table, and what do you think is going to be happening next from your point of view?
Well, my, you know, the problem with appellate work is that they have page limits. Mm-hmm. So, you know, because I think, T, when you and I were looking through the initial brief, we're like, God, why didn't they bring this up? Why didn't they bring that up? Why didn't they bring it? You know, and when you have those page limits, and they asked for an extension of pages, right? Mm-hmm. So they, in the court gave them that, but it was like, you have to pick and choose your battles, right? And the question, and so you're relying on the appellate counsel, and both Mark Lehman and Stacey Uliana are phenomenal Indiana appellate attorneys. Like they're as good as you can get in that state. And, you know, so you have faith that they went through everything and picked the things that they thought were the strongest things, you know. Again, I never want to be critical of other attorneys. You know, it's like, it's hard for me to do that. But when you select issues, when you had so many different things that you could have addressed that I thought were absolute Sixth Amendment issues that went right to the heart of what happened in this case. And you selected issues where, you know, or you should have known that there's going to be a waiver problem, meaning the defense didn't object at trial. It saddens me. So, you know, they're going to have the reply brief. And in the reply brief, it's exactly what it sounds like. You're replying to the state's arguments. It's not your opportunity to bring in all the things that you wish that you could have brought in or that you should have brought in your brief itself. So they're going to be somewhat limited there. And I hope against all hope that they're not going to try to get, you know, go to the appellate court on bended knee and say, look, you know, judges, the Constitution and fairness require you to give them a pass on the fact that they didn't object to trial, because that's a technicality. You know, they clearly had issues with this. They filed the requisite motions pre-trial. They clearly were denied hearings on these matters. And, you know, you can see that this is an issue that they were wanting to preserve for the appeal if he's convicted. And, you know, going it with hat in hand saying, you know, please, just from everything that Michael Osbrook tells me, and he's, I'll take his word to the bank every single day. They're not going to do it. They're going to say nope, wave. So what that means to me is that issues 3 and 4, which are the Nupui issue, and the third issue, which gets into the evidentiary stuff, and her barring it from coming in, is where they have to just lay waste. They have to just dig into that. I just prefer almost to see them concede, you know, like dedicate very little ink to those two top issues because I think it's a non-starter. Mm-hmm. So in my estimation, where I'd like to see them just make hay is getting to those next two things, because I think that those are potentially Napoui / Glossop is the final issue there. And again, this harkens back to the motion to correct error. And like I said, Michael Osbrook's a pretty smart guy. And that's where this case, I think, can end up in a new trial. Like I think that they're going to affirm on the first two just immediately. But I think 3 and 4, you've got some ability to make some real ground with the appellate court there.
What kind of probability you give this, Bob?
Yeah.
I don't know. I rely on, you know, guys that, and gals that practice in Indiana for kind of like, I don't know, Michael's, you know, he's given it like I haven't asked him for a percentage, you know, and I say that because I rely on people that argue in that state.
Sure.
You know, these judges, because for me to say it, having never argued in front of any of those judges and not doing appellate work there is kind of fruitless for me to guess, but if they address the Napoui Glossop issue fairly, he gets a new trial. So I mean that's
let me rephrase easier question on this. Do you think they're optimistic?
I think they're frankly more optimistic of it getting kicked up to the Indiana Supreme Court.
Is that the next step if this gets denied here?
Yeah, that's the next step.
So how does that look? What does that, you know, kind of roughly look like from a 10,000 foot level for a place we're not at yet?
So according to the people in the know from Indiana that do this for a living, they say that as to issues 1 and 2, that assuming that the appellate court affirms on all count, and affirm means that they're agreeing with the state, they're affirming the conviction. All right. So that's what that word means. Mm-hmm. So if they affirm on all counts at that point, they apply to the Indiana Supreme Court. I forget what the exact term of art is for the document that they file with them, where they're saying, hey, we really need you to take a look at this thing. And I believe Michael said that they look at it fresh, as opposed to relying on what the appellate court looked at. So they're going to look at it with fresh eyes. And he says that out of the two, that the Indiana Supreme Court is going to be far more inclined to look at the merits, that they might be willing to look past the waiver issues and get to the heart of the issues. So that's kind of how that thing looks. And, you know, whether or not that's going to happen is obviously going to depend on whether or not they affirm on what I think are the two. I mean, the third issue is relating to the fact that they couldn't put on a defense. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, to me, it's such a huge issue.
Yeah.
Literally barred them from being able to put on any kind of substantive defense. Like, and we're, you know, when she kept saying that there's no nexus, when you've got this guy saying that he spit on one of the girls and put, you know, sticks near her head, you know, like to make it look like antlers, and she's saying that there's no nexus when that person had no reason to know that sticks were left on the girls at all. Mm-hmm. In any way, shape, or form. If that's not somebody knowing about the facts of the crime, yeah. I don't know what is. Why is it, you know, and people are like, oh, well, that guy's got an IQ of a grapefruit. I don't give a shit.
Most people doing the shit do.
Yeah, that's a great point, Rob. Exactly.
How many times you say this?
Scientists out here doing this shit.
People actually had IQ above Forrest Gump on this, they wouldn't be doing these kinds of things. You know, there's zero EQ, emotional intelligence. IQs are always bottomed out. Everyone always thinks it's some big master scheme. No, these people are idiots.
There's not a lot of geniuses out there doing ritual killings in the woods, you know,
no.
And there's not a lot of even average intelligence people doing ritual killings in the woods. That takes a special type of stupid.
If you had average intelligence, you go out and get a job. You wouldn't have time to do this. You'd actually doing something productive for society and yourself and your family.
You mean you're not trying to please the Nordic gods?
People are so broken. The nutters, right?
Nutters. Yeah. Yeah. It's, I don't know, man. We'll see how it plays out. But
playing it even further ahead. We get to the Supreme Court level. Is that the end all? I mean, if they say, no, we don't agree.
No. I mean, in terms of, you know, kind of the appellate track, yes, it ends it. But, you know, you've got post-conviction world, which is
true.
Frankly where I've always thought that this thing is going to land. To be honest with you, just because, and again, I'm basing that on what people tell me about the Indiana appellate court,
right?
You know, but it, like, I'll get different answers from two people I really, really respect, you know, that are doing the work over there, where one of them's a lot more optimistic than the other, you know? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, you're really just guessing at this point, you know, again, I just really hope that the appellate court isn't going to like throw these two briefs in Claude and have it pump out an opinion and then basically say, this looks pretty good. You know, we'll go with it. You know, it's like the case is too important. There's real lives at stake here. Yeah. And I want an honest intellectual opinion to be drafted where they do the work themselves to kind of look into it. Because I think, you know, when you have intelligent people looking at this case, I think that most people land on, you know, kind of the side where they're scratching their head and saying, how was this guy convicted? You know, and that's not to say that people that believe that guilt, you know, that Alan's guilty are not intelligent people. I mean, maybe they are. Maybe they just haven't looked into the facts of the case.
They were limited to what they were allowed to be shown anyway. You know,
and it depends on who you listen to. You know, yeah. I mean, if you listen to Torch and Pitchfork people who think that everybody's guilty and that as soon as you're arrested that, you know, we don't even need trials in this country. Well, you know, there's no convincing them of anything other than he's guilty. You know what I mean? They're not hearing. They're not willing to listen. They're not willing to critically look at something. And you know, I mean, then that's fine. There's going to be people like that in this world. And there's plenty of them. You know, prosecutors rely on those people to get on the jury. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, it certainly happened in my estimation in this case, you know, and I always respect a verdict. Doesn't mean I agree with it, but I respect it. You know, I mean, they sat there and, you know, we only had the opportunity to hear from one of them, but no. So that post-conviction work is your quick answer. And essentially there, that's where you're bringing in newly discovered evidence. That's where you're going to see if there's any attacks on ineffective assistance of counsel, that's where you see it there, you know, because a lot of people are like, oh, you know, after they read the brief, you know, from the state, they're like, oh man, the defense really screwed up here. Like, why didn't they bring up ineffective assistance of counsel like in the brief? And really the problem is that you're limited to the record on direct appeal, meaning things that were done or not done, you know, strategically by the defense or were missed. They're not on the record.
Yeah.
Meaning that, you know, that it wasn't raised on the record. So there's nowhere that the appellate court can go through the huge record and be like, I don't see it anywhere. So that's where in post-conviction petitions, you're bringing up the things that should have been done, things that were done, that shouldn't have been done, you know, things, the people that should have been called, experts, all that stuff comes in post-conviction. And then you have the newly discovered evidence stuff. And, you know, I mean, here's the deal, man. Like, this is the reality. You've got victims, families out there that are feeling relief. You know, they have bought into what the state has sold them, that this is the right guy. They got the conviction on it, you know, and the thought of them having to go through it again is a nightmare. You know, it really is. And it's like, I feel great empathy for them. And
sure.
You know, but the reality is, if it's not the right guy, that ain't justice.
Exactly. There are feelings and there are facts, and they are two very different things. And just because if feelings are one thing, and yeah, I feel horrible for that. I cannot imagine being those families. But at the same point, it's not justice for your kids if you got the wrong guy. Even if it lets you sleep at night, if you're able to compartmentalize it so much and block out all of the noise, all the information that contradicts how the people that you trusted got there, the only thing you do is just kind of take some comfort in that you didn't get there. These people did, and they were wrong. That's not your fault they got there into that wrong of a way and dug you down there and kept telling you, we're right. We got the right guy. You were bamboozled by these fucks.
Yeah.
If you really want the right guy, take a look at the whole reality of this and let's figure out who the hell it is. They might already be dead, but let's at least get there.
That's where I'm at.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
like this thing's, if Alan gets a new trial, or if they think, you know, because here's what would happen. If he gets a new trial, whether it be granted by the appellate court or the Indiana Supreme Court or post-conviction world, you know, down the road, and he's granted a new trial. But post-conviction is a very difficult way to go about it. Yeah. It's lengthy. You know, you've seen it in some recent cases. You've seen it in that Corn Rake Killer case with Todd Mullis, and then more recently with Zach Adams with the Holly Bobo case, both of which we've covered. I did abandon Mullis, so I don't want to hear it in the chat. I know I did. But, you know, it's a real, real tough road to hoe. Yeah. It just is. Yeah. It's a lengthy battle. And ultimately, at the end of the day, you worry if he gets a new trial, and I believe that they would retry him, as stupid as that seems, but I think that they would do it because they're all in on it. And if he's acquitted, I sadly think that this is a case that is never going to get solved. And it could be, Tony, because of what you just said, that the actual killer is dead.
Yeah.
That's what I believe, but that's my opinion. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love to hear from you on this. Share this. More people that are aware of this, the more pressure gets put on for this to go somewhere. So please do that. Bob Mata, Defense Diaries. Go check it out wherever you get podcasts and on YouTube. Just search Defense Diaries. And Robin's new book, it is out. It's not all about me. It's available wherever you get books. Go check that out.
It's all about Bob.
Yeah. What about Bob?
What about Bob?
Baby steps. All right. Yeah. All right. Until next time, for Robin, for Todd, for Bob, I'm Tony. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.